Hi, everybody, and welcome to the latest and greatest edition of the Fangirl Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Jessica Dwyer, and this is our post-Comic-Con edition, and I would like to thank Horrorhound Magazine for partnering with us on this one. Their latest issue, issue number 30, is the comic book issue, and there's some great articles and histories in there of horror comics, movie tie-in comic books, and as well as coverage of Fright Night, which has, I believe, the only interview with David Tennant that goes along with the Fright Night film that's coming out next. Well, actually, I guess it's this month now. And also a retrospective on the original film, as well as a retrospective on Creepshow. And it's a great, great issue. It's a special issue to a lot of us on the staff of the magazine because it is our five-year anniversary issue. And be sure to check that out. You can get that at Barnes & Noble, comic book retailers, Hastings, if you have a Hastings in your area, and as well as through the website. And now, back to the Comic-Con coverage. Comic-Con this year was probably the biggest I have ever been to. It was massive. I'm not lying when I say that I was trapped on a sidewalk for 30 minutes just trying to cross the street. There were so many people, and part of the craziness was the fact that it was more, I believe it was probably more stretched out, sprawling this time than any other year previous. There were lots of off-site events. There were lots of areas that were across the street from the convention center that had taken over areas. I had never seen so much. Just basically, they took over the entire gas lamp. The crowds are huge. There were panels in the Hilton and the Marriott. That part is hard to do and deal with because you have to basically run the entire length of the convention center to get to either one of those hotels because they're either in. So it was really busy, as I've said, and a lot of people weren't very happy about how crowded it was. And but you know, that's part of Comic-Con. It's going to be crowded, but this time it was just really crowded. And yeah, once again, I found myself pinned against a display case at the Marvel booth, but it wasn't horrible. And part of the thing that I find amusing, if you can find something amusing in all of that, is the fact that even with the crowds and with how packed in people are at this show, there's hardly any, you know, bad things that happen, like violent acts or anything like that. Now, everybody knows about the stabbing in Hall H, the eyeball deal with the pen, but considering how many people converge on San Diego in that area, considering how many there are, and it really in comparison to how many people are there, how small an area it is, there could be a lot worse going on, and there's not. And I think that's testament to sci-fi fans, comic book fans, and horror movie fans, and people like that, that we know there's sort of a family vibe throughout it, and I really appreciate that fact. You know, it could be a lot harder and be a lot more dangerous, but it really isn't in that way, at least not yet. Now, granted, there were still some things that went on. I think everybody and their brother heard about the Rice Iphens incident, and I don't really know what the whole story is on that. There was some conflicting reports about him shoving the security guard, but like I said, in the grand scheme of things, that isn't so bad. I mean, it's, you know, there could have been a lot worse if you had seen the sidewalks and all the things going on there. In terms of the crowds, it was just a lot of people, and you know, more, you know, give it to us geeks. We don't really go for that kind of stuff, and as yet. So, is it getting more crowded? Yes. Is it getting more packed? Is it really, really exhausting? Yes, it is. Is it still worth it? I think it is. I mean, there's stuff at Comic-Con that you are never going to find or see or have that experience of witnessing just this mass of it really is geek mecca. So, yes, Comic-Con is still worth it. It's still tiring. It's still crowded. But it's still worth it. There's something special about the whole event. So, that being said, it's kind of interesting. This year, everybody was talking about how Saturday was sort of tamed down. It typically is Saturday is the day that everybody and their brother wants to be there. But this year, they didn't really have that. It was funny how they moved everything to Sunday. And that was due to a lot of the fact that, Warner Brothers didn't have a presence there this year, really, in terms of their films, like they normally do. There was quite a bit of people angry about that, and some of that, too, has to do with, I think, Disney's going to have their own convention starting, I think they already did one or two, but they're kind of holding their cards to their chest in terms of content. They're going, since they own Marvel now, and their new convention, they're going to have basically like one day of Disney, one day of maybe Pirates of the Caribbean, for example, and then a whole day dedicated to Marvel Comics. So they're kind of Comic-Con's now got competition in their own client base, if you want to get technical about it, with Disney. So that was part of it, and it was interesting because on, I believe it was Friday, I just walked right into Hall H a couple of times, which, if for those who know about the mythical Hall H, that's not normal. Usually there's a line. Sometimes you get lucky. But this one, this time, I actually, few things I went in there, I had the time to go do, I just walked right in, which was nice, and so it was, but the funny thing was, one of the interesting things was because of how they packed it in on Sunday, closed Ballroom 20, which is where they typically have their TV content, Hall H was crazy, and there was like a line of 4,000 people to get in, on Sunday, which is unheard of, and that was due to Supernatural, Doctor Who being in there. And so what happened was Sunday was the big day to try and get in there, and you couldn't. I'm sure that may have irritated some people, because with how it typically plays out, no one tries to get Sunday passes. They all try to get a Saturday pass, and this year it was sort of opposite. So there is a little bit of a recap for the everyday stuff on there, actually attending and going around. The things that I got to see in Hall H were awesome. I got to see the first footage from Prometheus, which is Ridley Scott's new science fiction film, and that was mind-bendingly cool. Charlize Theron was there in attendance, and then they did a video feed with Ridley, and we got to see footage of the film, and it looks beautiful. Not much given away in plot. You do know it's on a ship, and there's some sort of alien menace there. Not necessarily the aliens, but definitely something is up, something is wrong. And it looks gorgeous. I'm very glad to see that he's turning back to sci-fi again, because the man's a legend in that genre. So that's great. We also got to see, once again, some footage from Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, which is Guillermo del Toro's new horror. He's actually producing this new horror film that's a remake of a 70s TV movie, which looks really, really scary and creepy, and we got to see sketches of the creatures in it, and they're hideous. We also got to see footage of Ryan Gosling being a badass in the new movie Drive. The scene that we got to watch, I can only compare to the scene in Pan's Labyrinth where the man gets the bottle repeatedly shoved into his face. That was on par with the shock value of this scene. And we also, one of the really cool highlights of this whole the convention was Francis Ford Coppola was there, and he brought not only a new film that he's working on, but a new sort of way of viewing film and software. The movie is called Twixt, and it stars Val Kilmer as a writer who he gives up on a series of books that he's writing that he's well known for. He wants to do something personal, something on his own. And he goes to a town and discovers a mystery surrounding these murders. They're called the vampire murders because the bodies have stakes driven through their chests. And it's sort of surreal, and helping him along in his journey into investigating this is the ghost of Edgar Allan Poe. Now, what's cool about the movie is only certain parts of it are in 3D, which is nice, so you don't have to wear the glasses the whole time. But also Coppola has created, Zoetrope Pictures has partnered with programmers to create a new sort of software that a director can watch an audience's reaction to a film. And if there's a certain musical tone, if there's a certain kind of part of the script that an audience responds to better than another, they can go in and immediately make changes to the film, edit it on the spot, and reshuffle or change the music to change the tone of a scene, or give more comedy if they react more to comedy in that scene, or increase the suspense in that scene right on the spot. And it's really amazing because he showed how this works. It's definitely a lot more organic and a lot more audience, one-on-one of an experience with theater or actually cinema, if you want to get. And he showed it with the trailer that they had brought for Twixt. And it was neat to see it happen. It's still a little buggy because it was like the first live, one of the first live occurrences of him using it, but it works, and it was really neat to see it happen. And what it does is it makes it an original experience for the audience, no matter whichever audience is that you're in. Whenever you see the movie, it's going to be a different experience for you. Even if it is the same film, it's going to be different. And it sort of harkens back to those days of in the silent film era, because it depending on if there was like a live band there performing music to the film, it changes with the musician. And so what Coppola is wanting to do, and he also had his music guy there, and he changed up the tunes that were being used on the cues in the footage. What happens is you get that new experience, and he is wanting to go on tour with this film for a month before it's released and do live presentations using this software and being there with the movie so he can play this out for everyone. So it's pretty neat. It's a really cool concept, and like I said, it harkens back to those olden days of silent cinema where you had a live band there, and depending upon how that conductor wanted it to go, you got a different experience with the film just because of the music alone, because music is so important in tone, and Coppola is a master. He knows this, and so that it's a neat thing. So Twixt is definitely cool. Plus, bonus Edgar Allan Poe's ghost is in it. And it's just a neat, neat concept. I was very happy that I got to see that be shown. So that was one of the cooler things to see at Comic-Con this year. Of course, there was all the exclusive little goodies that they were giving away at the the booths and the exhibition hall, and then there were the exclusives that like Maddie Collector and Hasbro were giving away. And once again this year, it never fails. All of that becomes more hellish than it needs to be, I think. Hasbro sold out of everything immediately, and what they end up doing is they'll limit the number of exclusives that you can buy, not just you specifically, but during the day they'll limit it to a number. And Hasbro does that. Maddie Collector did that, and the Maddie Collector thing was sort of horrible because if you pre-ordered, which I did on some of the stuff, you can do that before the show, so you're guaranteed in a way the items. What happened was pre-orders had to go all the way to another hotel. You couldn't get it at their booth. You had to go to the Marriott down the street from the down at the far end of the convention center. You had until 6 o'clock to pick it up on Saturday if you pre-ordered. If you didn't pick it up by six, then you forfeited your item and your money. They were going to resell it, and they're not giving you a refund. And part of the problem was, one of the bigger items that people wanted this time around was they had a really beautiful DeLorean from Back to the Future. And what happened on Saturday was the shipment was delayed. And I don't know why. I think it may have had something to do with just the amount of traffic. I'm not certain. But they weren't going to be there until almost 1:30 in the afternoon. So if you got there first thing in the morning and you had planned to have that done and you wanted to see something in the afternoon, well, you were screwed because you had to figure out a way to get back there by 1:30 along with everybody else that wanted a DeLorean and get in line. And so it's rough when you're a collector, and especially with items like that, to get them. It really is, and that's why you'll find them later on eBay being sold for almost four times as much money. Hell, sometimes it doesn't even take that long. People will buy them and then go to their booth if they have one of the booths at the convention and just mark it up twice as much and sell it right there to get, and you pay it if you really want the item because you want one, and they're limited. And I don't go for that. I think that's wrong, and I'm sure a lot of other people think it is too, but that's just part of the culture that's expected with Comic-Con and the exclusive goodies that you can get there. It's like right now, if you go on eBay, you can find the, they were giving out the, back when I said I got smashed into a display case, that was due to, I just wanted an Iron Man poster from the Marvel booth, and I saw them handing them out, walked over and grabbed one, and all of a sudden everyone else seemed to notice that they were giving them out, and I had 30 people pushing me into a display case. So crowd mentality, yeah, not so much. But those posters, which are beautiful, they're the Avengers posters, character posters. Right now, if you go on eBay, you can see where people are selling them for almost $50 a piece. They're free. They were given out only a week ago, and they're already being marked up to $50 a pop on eBay. So this is a way for people to get back, I guess, their ticket price on things. Personally, I want to keep the stuff. That's why I went. It's part of the reason you go is to get this cool stuff. But if you can't make it, this is a way for you to get a piece of Comic-Con. But yeah, it's a little, that's the culture. The collectibles go up for sale on eBay. Another one that was, I noticed for certain, people were definitely going to be reselling them. I walked by some guys when I was heading to the room where they were giving out the prepay figures, and I saw these guys. They had about 14 or 15 of those Stay Puft Marshmallow Men. They had these giant size ones that I believe were around $70-$75, and they had bought 12 of them at least. So yeah, that's you know, they get around the limits that people put on them too, because there's only supposed to be like two or three per person. And but that's, like I said, the culture, and that is Comic-Con. But there was some great other great stuff. They had the Fright Night panel, and that David Tennant recorded a little pre-recorded message for everybody, because he couldn't be there. He's in the UK doing Much Ado About Nothing. But they had a surprise guest in the form of Chris Sarandon, who plays Jerry Dandridge, and in the original, and he moderated the panel, which was great. That was a nice little nod to fans of the original film. The Ghost Rider had Ghost Rider number 2 had some footage shown, and Nicolas Cage was in attendance with Idris Elba, who was also a co-stars in it. Neville Dean and Taylor are the directors, and they're the guys responsible for Crank and Crank 2 and Gamer, which is some crazy, crazy stuff. I can't wait to see what they do with Ghost Rider, because it's truly, those guys make some of the most visually stunning stuff now, I think. They it's really kinetic and crazy, and they don't mind, they're kind of like Robert Rodriguez, they don't mind doing crazy, crazy stuff to get a shot that looks spectacular on screen. I know there's people that hate Crank and hate Crank 2, and just, they don't see the appeal, but it's supposed to be insane like that, and it's supposed to be like a video game. So that's awesome. I'm happy to see these guys getting bigger and better deals, especially something like this, where their style and Nicolas Cage coming together is going to be off the chain, you know it. So I'm really excited about that. So yeah, they also had John Cusack that was there for The Raven, and that was amazing. Cusack I don't believe has ever shown up to a Comic-Con before. And it's great to get to see, it's, you know, Poe is big this year, I guess. It was sort of weird to see not only in Twixt, but The Raven, and then the rumored TV series where he's solving crimes is also going to, you know, that may happen, may not happen. But it's very interesting to see how suddenly Edgar Allan Poe is everywhere. So I think that this year was a pretty great Comic-Con. It just was really busy and big. And there was a lot of horror in attendance, too, in terms of with Fright Night. They also had The Walking Dead everywhere you went. True Blood was everywhere you went. So horror definitely took a major role in Comic-Con this year, which always makes me happy. And speaking to True Blood, as said and promised, we have an interview with Michael McMillian, talking about his new series of True Blood comics called Tainted Love. And Tainted Love you can also not only buy at your local comic store, but is also available on Apple iTunes as a downloadable app, which will allow you to read the comics. This series is a great idea that he had with this one, about tampered true blood causing vampires to just lose it, and it's a group has decided to turn the true blood against the vampires by making them lose their minds and destroying even more of their reputation as a race after what happened with Russell Eddington and his infamous ripping the spine or heart out of the guy on network television, and then telling everyone that he's going to eat your babies. So without further ado, here's Michael, and it's pretty hilarious. When I called him up, he was heading to a comic book store to go shopping. So represent, comic book geeks, and here you go.
This is Michael McMillian, everybody. You probably know him well as Steve Newland on True Blood, but he's also a comic book writer, and he is writing the second series of True Blood comic books called Tainted Painted Love, and it's actually excellent. I've been reading them, and they're great.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome. And could you just repeat what you just told me, which I think is hilarious and awesome, that where you're going?
Well, I'm in Kansas right now. I grew up in Kansas City, and I'm shooting a short film back here that that I wrote and I'm directing. And we were on a location scout today, and I just took a lunch break. I have my first AD in the car with me, so he might try to hop on this, but I'm not going to let him. But you were literally calling. I, of course, because I'm an idiot, I forgot. I wasn't paying attention to the time, and I was about to walk into a comic book store, as you called, to pick up the new League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Ooh, Alan Moore. That's
big fan. I mean, who isn't?
Oh.
It's kind of amazing. I love that series. That series is so good.
Oh, it's so,
so weird.
It's so neat. It's such a neat concept, too. They didn't do go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think a lot of people have, I think there's sort of a contingent of readers have sort of abandoned the series since it stopped taking place in Victorian England. Like, the Black Dossier came out, and people were kind of like, I don't know what this is. You know, but I've just gotten, the weirder it's gotten, the more integral and into fiction, the world of fiction, the deeper it's gotten, and the more obscure the references become. I kind of like that. You know, I kind of like having to look up things that I don't, characters that I don't know. You know, so all of it's British. You know, so many British references in there of stuff that we didn't get over here. So it's really become this bizarre.
Well, yeah, and he took
it. I love it.
He took it into the 60s, didn't he?
The book is 1969, where they're getting Mick Jagger to give birth to father of the Antichrist.
Oh, there's a nod to American Pie. That's awesome.
That's right. It's pretty cool.
That's really neat. So I had to ask where. Because I'm a huge fan of this new the True Blood comics, and I love how you're taking this the new series. How did the idea for this specific storyline come from?
Actually, the idea for the Tainted Blood came from my co-writer Mark Andrako. He'd done some work with IDW, and you know, I of course had worked on the show and. He's a neighbor of mine, friend of mine, Mark. Just, you know, he wrote this great series for DC called Manhunter, where he reinvented the Manhunter character as this lawyer, Kate Spencer, turned it into a female character, and it's just a really good run on that book, and he's done a bunch of other stuff. He's coming out with a new, he's working with Ed Brubaker on Captain America and Bucky for Marvel, which is coming out, I think, later this summer.
Nice.
Just a really talented writer, good guy, loves comics. We had talked about just getting together and pitching, working together to pitch stories to IDW and HBO for the book. I think we sat down with a list of ideas, and that was one of the first ones he mentioned, was like, what if we had a product scare with True Blood, kind of like the Tylenol scare years ago, or like the Toyota Priuses, the brakes giving out. And then it just kind of took off from there, and it worked. And I thought it was a great idea because that seems to be, you know, the comic, I think, can really flesh out the mythology of the show. That's really what the comic's role should be, you know, because it's tough because we can't really break in too tightly into the continuity of the show because those episodes take place back to back, you know. So our stories have to run parallel, and sometimes. You know, you can get into the danger of feeling like these stories are non-canonical, you know, because the first question is, when does this stuff tie into the book? So I think that the role of the comic is, let's take corners of the True Blood universe that the show probably won't touch upon, like a product scandal, like the product scandal of True Blood being poison, and turn that into a story, you know?
Right, but it lets you give some depth to the characters and give you a lot more interaction and things like that than you normally have.
And we both just love Jessica as a character. And I think, you know, around the time we were pitching the story, the series was starting to tease that she kind of had this wilder side to her that really wanted to let loose, and that's what we really wanted the story to be about. You know, to me, the idea of, like, in the first issue, Hoyt's trying to give Jessica a high school prom, an experience that she never would have had, even if she hadn't been turned into a vampire because she was homeschooled.
Right.
And you know, I think we have this idea of this need at the beginning of the story that these characters are really trying to recapture or find an innocence that none of them probably ever had, you know? And then they're thrust into a situation that reminds them of the world that they live in and that they always live in danger and that they're never going to live normal lives.
Right.
And that's kind of what I found interesting, you know, to explore with everybody.
Yeah, and some of them just, they've forgotten how to be that innocent because they've been
this way for
so long.
Well, there's characters like Sookie who, you know, she's always been able to read minds. She's always been able to hear the thoughts of other people, the dirty thoughts of other people, and she never lived a normal life, so she's never had, you know, an innocent, she's never had a sense of innocence herself. You know, so there's this sort of false hope that all these characters, I think, have, or you would have if you lived in that world of, like, when could I, you know, we live in a world where we dream of vampires and fantasy lives, and, you know, we escape to these genre shows and our comic books because our life is so mundane, and I think the joke is probably just wish for a more mundane life that they're never, ever going to have.
Right, like, she's, like, never went on a, well, she has gone on dates, but they've always been horrible because she knows what they want out of her at the end.
Yeah, so exactly.
It's like, that's what's so tragic about the show. You want them to make it, and, like, right now with Eric's character, they're doing such great things with that whole memory loss storyline with him. You're seeing
right.
the whole side of him, and
right.
I think that's awesome, and it's great to see that fleshed out in the comics, because I know in the first set they showed a lot of Eric's background, and you got to see some of the stuff that led up to his. I love seeing flashbacks to other periods in there, too. That's always
yeah,
great.
Me too. And I love it in the show when they do that. That's always one of my favorite things. When, you know, I love this season when they flash back to Bill and his punk days, you know, pretending to be a punk in London in the 80s. Like, that's so cool. And, you know, there could be a whole, you know, I think there could be a whole comic series that just focused on that, you know?
Oh, yeah, it would be great for, like, each issue to focus on one of the vampires' background. You know, like, something that would be really neat, because I'd love to see what Pam used to do.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, she's a great character.
So, I know that it's obvious that you're a massive, massive comic book fan. What sort of comics did you read growing up, and did you go for more of the superhero or the supernatural or kind of both?
Yeah, you know, I was much more, I was always kind of taken in by the superhero stuff initially. You know, when I was little, I drew. I really wanted to be an artist, and I thought I was going to be a Disney animator when I grew up, or a comic book artist. Before I found acting, and acting was a lot more social, and there were always pretty girls around, and you know, I'd never had the discipline to sit down and draw. I would always sit down, and I just would want it to be done right away, you know.
Oh, I know.
To look perfect. So I never really, you know, I kind of left. Kind of sad, I guess, but I kind of left drawing before I could really pick up any real technique and really learn the discipline and enjoy the process of sitting down and drawing. But I got it, you know, I kind of always remember having comic books around as a kid, but I really started collecting during the David Michelinie, Todd McFarlane run of Amazing Spider-Man. That was that. I mean, Spider-Man was always my favorite character, and then I just remember Todd McFarlane's art looking so different, so cool, and you know, it was he had those big eyes and the really intricate lines and the long spindly limbs, and it didn't look like the Spider-Man that I grew up with Spidey Super Stories. And I was like, oh, you know, I think that's when I realized the comics could really do something different with old characters and could be something, you know, it was really kind of a special art form.
So, did you ever read any of his F. Spawn?
You know, I was so mad. My buddy David and I, when we were kids, I was so mad that those guys left Marvel. I was really, really loyal to Marvel as a kid. And I think I picked up the first couple issues of Spawn. I was just hated it. You know, I was just so mad that that Eric Larson and Jim Lee and all those guys had left all my favorite books to go do their own thing. And, you know, looking back, I get it. You know, those guys were miserable working at Marvel at the time, but, you know, it was so good. You know, Marvel was so good during those years that when those guys left, I felt burned. I felt like they left me for somebody better looking. And I was mad, so I didn't really get into Spawn. I collected Savage Dragon for a while, but I was really mad at Todd McFarlane. And plus, at the time, I didn't really get into horror movies and all that stuff until later, until college, actually. And I think some of that stuff, even his run on Spider-Man, when he left to just do the solo Spider-Man title and did Torment, you know, I remember it just being kind of too dark for me at the time. I didn't really appreciate it. I would like my comics to be a little bit more optimistic, a little bit funnier.
Yeah, those definitely weren't at the beginning. They were...
Yeah.
So, it sounds... I also do a line called Lucid, and that kind of... you kind of took, like, supernatural and hero and kind of meshed them in that.
Yeah. You know, you can definitely see in that book everything that I loved growing up. There's a bit of superhero, there's a bit of James Bond and Indiana Jones, and then Arthurian legends. You know, the series is that... It's about takes place in a world where major world powers have secret agents working for them that are trained in magic and sorcery. It's kind of the idea of, like, what if Obama had his own Merlin, you know? And it was just kind of an idea that really stuck, and I really dug, and immediately a whole universe kind of was born out of that. And the main character is Matthew D. He's the newly appointed protector of the realm of the United States, and he works for this president named Jefferson Monday. The idea in the first series is that the concept of Camelot it wasn't just a specific time in history. It's this golden age that keeps trying to come back and reconstitute itself so humanity can kind of rise to a new level. And every time Camelot starts to form itself on Earth, it's destroyed. You know, it's destroyed back in the Arthurian times. And then I took the idea of Kennedy's administration being called Camelot, so that it was like coming back in the 60s, and then it was taken down with his assassination. And now, at the onset of the first volume, the mages that are in Matthew D's order, they think the prophecy of Camelot is happening again, that there's going, you know, the new Arthurian leader called the Pendragon is going to return and rebuild Camelot for a golden age. And there's a bad guy out there, a cult weapons dealer, who's claiming the mantle of the Pendragon. So Matthew is, the prophecy sort of been twisted on its head, and Matthew's trying to track down this guy and bring his sort of dark Camelot to an end before it can happen.
That is awesome.
Yeah, I don't know, nerdy stuff.
I'm the biggest geek you're gonna meet, I think. So that's all good. So,
I've always been a big fan of the occult and paranormal and UFOs, and I thought about trying to do that and tell what I call the 21st century fairy tale with Lucid, where you kind of take all these fantasy elements and set them in modern times and tie it into. Aliens and the Illuminati and all of this stuff, you know, that I just love.
Well, it's good fodder for stories. I mean, all of that, it's crazy good. Like, I mean, look at, what they did with Angels and Demons and the Da Vinci Code. That stuff's like, gold for storytellers.
Yeah, I always wanted those books to go a little bit more supernatural, though. Do that, but make it a little. That's what was so great about Raiders of the Lost Ark is for the first, three-fourths of that film, it's all really real. You know, it all could just be have this great scene where you realize that Indiana Jones actually lives not only in a historical world, but a supernatural world as well. And I love that stuff.
Right. You know? Well, when the guy's face melts off, you're like, oh, well, damn.
Okay, there's ghosts in this universe. That's cool.
And that's kind of like, that's what's so cool about urban fantasy right now. It's just taken off with like True Blood and Laurel K. Hamilton's books and Jim Butcher's books. I think that's kind of like a feeding into our current state of mind, where reality is so sucky so often that it'd be great to just think and hope that there's something other out there in the world next to us.
Yeah, and at the same time, I think that, it's the sense of it's either going to get really better or it's going to get really worse, and we don't really know. We're at this kind of crossroads right now, as a culture and as a society. And I think people are freaked out, and I think that reality in some ways is starting to feel more unreal every day. And it's kind of like, okay, is it going to be a reality where we all get superpowers and everyone's cool, or is this going to turn into The Walking Dead?
And
it's going to go one way or another.
Well, yeah, and like the stuff in Oslo, just it was horrible. Stuff. And it's like, we need something happy. We need something positive in that. Mm-hmm. And kind of feeding into that. I've talked to people that are, other writers and creators and artists, and a lot of people say they see comics and shows like Doctor Who and True Blood and Star Trek as sort of the new form of mythology, our new fables, like our new folklore. As a writer and creator of this stuff, do you see that too? Do you see this as the place now in modern times where we're going to go back and, instead of like, say, Johnny Appleseed or those kind of stories, we're going to go to comics and we're going to go to Doctor Who to find our new folklore?
Yeah, I do. I think that's fair. I mean, obviously, what's happening now is tied into things that have come before. Superman is the Christ myth redone. He's Apollo. He's the sun god. He gets his powers from, the sun, the thing that keeps everybody alive. And he always comes back. He can't beat him. He's died and he's come back again. So he's really just a reinterpretation of the Christ myth. And so things it's old ideas and new packages. And I think that we'll keep having those. But I think it's fair. I think that where comics come in, why I think they're such an effective form of folklore mythology is you can pick it up fast. Comics are there, and they kind of creep in on the fringes of society, and they become more and more well-established and more prominent. But, you can go down and you can pick up a Superman comic book or a Spider-Man comic book at the corner drugstore, or you can get it online, or comic book stores everywhere. So I think, in that sense, a comic story, that mythology is always in reach. It's always immediate. And I think that's really appealing to people. And our summer movies now are all comic book heroes. So I think there is some truth to that. I think it's also just a way to process some older stories that maybe we've kind of had too much of a cultural divide from,
Yeah.
Too many years between us and some of the, it's tricky. You don't want to get into offending anybody's religion, but, stories of the Bible are 2,000 years old, and some of the more amazing stories of, David versus Goliath and Jonah and the whale and all these things, we have stories that are just like that now in comic book form that I think are more immediate and more accessible and more relatable. Not that they're substitutes for somebody's faith, but speaking strictly about folklore, they're there, and I think they're definitely part of that.
Well, and a lot of people, I remember watching on the Stan Lee's Finding the Real Superhero series. They did not too long ago on this Sci-Fi Channel. One of the guys on there was talking about how basically Stan Lee helped him become a man. He found comics because he had no father. His dad left, and he considered Stan Lee and his work to have been his basis for finding who he was and how to be a good person.
Well, I love that stuff. And, you know, Grant Morrison has a book out right now called Super Gods that I'm reading, and he talks about this stuff. He talks about how, you know, Superman, I love this, he talks about how the nuclear bomb started off as an idea, you know, that came into fruition, and the superhero, Superman, is also an idea. And he's like, that's a better idea than the bomb. The superhuman is a better idea than a bomb. That's something we should be working towards as a society. You know, that Superman really is this great role model for kids. And, you know, not that, you know, a healthy childhood should rely on comic book superheroes as role models, but, I mean, I was that way when I was a kid, too. I loved Spider-Man. I loved Peter Parker. I loved those characters. And I, you know, I remember thinking, like, well, I don't want to shoplift because, you know, Peter Parker wouldn't do that. You know what I mean? And it's such a kind of square thing. I'd probably be a lot cooler if somebody like, I don't know.
Deadpool.
I was going to say, yeah, I mean, he was a douchebag at the point.
But kind of going into that, just picking up on that, sort of going into that whole, that part of the use of the comic books in storytelling, and it's not just that, but like definitely True Blood goes into this too, is the use of genre stuff like sci-fi, horror, and fantasy as a way to talk about subjects like racism, bigotry, you know. I think that's lost on a lot of, some people don't get that these shows are great morality tales, and really,
oh, sure.
And really,
yeah,
useful for that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you can trace that back to the X-Men. You know, the X-Men was always kind of that way, even back in its early incarnation, of that there are misfits in society, and there are people who are misunderstood, I think all of Marvel Comics kind of really started to make that happen, really bring the genre a little bit closer to the reader, you know, because the people who love this stuff, you know, we tend to feel like misfits. We tend to look at the world a little bit differently than some of our peers and go, gosh, you know, like, I don't fit into this crowd, or I don't necessarily believe all the things these people believe. And I think that's, you know, another great function that genre has. There is the escapism from that world that you're just like, oh god, you know, like, I hate high school, I hate this, you know, so it provides escape. But I think it's been this, you know, it's no surprise that you have, you know, a place like San Diego Comic Con where just hundreds of thousands of people come dressed in costumes, and, you know, it's like, it's no surprise that genre brings people together as an audience. Like, very few things do, you know?
Right. And
I think it's just because it's like, it's kind of, it's the form of storytelling that tells everyone to let their free flag fly, you know? People love it, you know?
Right, and it's always funny to me, like, this year there was a couple of instances where things happened, like, sort of violent, and then, of course, we had the eye stabbing the year before. But,
yeah, what happened this year? Was there stuff?
There was an incident with an actor, actually,
really?
From Spider-Man. And,
oh, yeah, okay, yeah, I heard about this.
There was no eye stabbing, let's put it that way. That's a good thing.
Right, but it's
so awesome that you have that, because I don't know, were you there this year? Because I didn't get a chance.
I was.
You saw the crowds.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is it's just gotten so big now.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of, and I think, you know, I think what we're seeing now is that you have the hundreds of thousands of genre fans, but then you're dumping a bunch of people into that group that don't really get it, you know, that don't really understand the stuff, don't really get it, and I think, like, you know, that's not responsible for these things necessarily, but I think there is this sort of, there are kind of two huge two groups. There's the Hollywood group and then the fan group, you know, and they don't always mesh.
Right, you know? And some of it, it's still impressive, though, to me that you have almost 200,000 people and you don't have hardly anything violent-wise happen. And I think that's testament to the type of people that love this stuff.
Yeah, I do too. But it's just interesting that things have kind of started to boil up in the past couple of years, little small things, and I wonder if it's just because they're, I don't know, it's like there's too much of an invasion from the commercial Hollywood side into it. I don't know. But you're right. I mean, that's the thing, is these are all, these are people who also bring weapons into, people are bringing
real freaking weapons
with them into the convention hall, and everything's cool.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that it is a kind of cause for celebration. I think people get excited. I mean, I get excited when I'm around. I mean, oh my God! Like, you know, I've been collecting the line of Marvel Universe action. Like, I'll go years without collecting any toys or any of that kind of stuff, and then I'll just go through a phase where I'm just, you know, hunting for all that stuff. And I remember I was over at the Hasbro toy booth talking to one of the toy designers, and I was like, oh yeah, you gotta be this guy, I really like the way you know, what you did with the Falcon, that was really cool. I'm just, like, listening to myself. And I'm like, wow, I really needed someone to talk to about these action figures. I'm so thankful that I'm speaking to somebody who understands my pain. You know?
To geek out over stuff like that, because, you know, you don't get a chance to in everyday life very often, and when you can, man, it's great, especially when they talk your language. It's so cool.
Things are so special, you know, to us, and it's just fun. It's always great to talk to other people who are into it, and you're like, oh yeah, I'm not alone, great. Or just the wealth of useless information that starts coming out of your mouth.
Oh, God.
Talk to somebody else who's a comic reader, just like, why do I know the history of Johnny Storm's love life? When am I ever going to use this in society? Nowhere. It's useless. Meanwhile, you know, I can't do long division to save my life. But
by God, I know who he slept with in issue 233.
Yeah, exactly.
Fantastic Four.
I can tell you when Johnny found out that he was married to a Skrull. You know? Thanks, college.
That's hilarious and true. I understand. So, kind of going back to True Blood. Do you have any interest in writing for the show itself now that you've done the comic?
I would love to. I mean, I think the show is in really capable hands, so kind of a tight-knit group over there, and there are far better writers to be working on that show right now, but that's, you know, really where the writing from the comic came from, the urge. I really wanted to write spec for the show or something, you know, and let them read it, and they're like, we can't really... If you wrote a sample episode, we really probably, you know, we could take a look for legal reasons and all this stuff, and I was like, oh, man, you know. And then when I heard the comic was coming out, I was like, well, here's a chance to write these characters, you know, because they're just such great characters, and the actors have done such, you know, I'm taking myself out of the equation here, but the actors on the show have done such a great job of establishing their voices that as both an actor and a writer, like, I was just dying to play with all of those other characters.
Well, and I love what you did with Jessica and the alligator. That's all I'm going to say.
Thanks. I think that one, I love it. All these great ideas, none of them I can take credit for. I think that one came from Alan Ball himself. I think we had another animal in there, and Alan was like, making an alligator. So, there's your Alan Ball moment.
That was great.
Yeah, it's great.
So, Speaking of all the characters and everything, I know you're busy, and I'm going to let you go shop for comics, but I had to ask this question of you. If you could tackle any other role on the show, who would you want to do?
Now, would I have the acting abilities of the other actors, or is this me, like, do I become the other actors playing the role, or is it me playing the role?
You get to play the role.
Alright, if I got to play the role, well, I mean, I would just love to play Lafayette. You know, like, that character is so much fun. It would, you know, completely miscast, but I think, like, that role is so much fun. I'd love to play. I'd love to play Lafayette. You know, get away with a lot of stuff playing Eric, too, which would be great. But I don't know. There's just so many great characters on that show. So many good actors. Dennis O'Hare, Russell Edgington. God,
oh my God,
Made me want to go back and redo all of season two of Steve Nolan. You know, just like this guy, that's how you do it.
I was running around quoting that, "We will eat you," all the time.
Yeah, that scene was so great.
You believed him.
Guy, find out. Yeah, he's like, "We're gonna eat your babies."
And we're gonna eat your face, and then we're gonna laugh and eat your children. That's what we're gonna do.
Yeah. Oh, loved it.
So can we expect anything of Mr. Newland to come back this season?
I don't know. I don't know. You know, he's missing, which isn't a good sign. But I've heard that there's more, you'll learn more about, it's a mystery that's running through this season for a reason, and viewers haven't heard the last about Steve Newland, for sure. I don't know. I'm hoping he'll survive.
I was curious what he
made it. I made it through this far.
Yeah, and that's more than some can say this season.
Yeah, yeah.
I was gonna say, I wonder what would happen if he came back as a vampire. I was wondering, like,
oh wow, yeah. Oh my gosh, that'd be great. I don't know.
That would be messed up.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is I think everybody on the show is like, I remember we were working on season two, it's like everybody wanted to be turned into a vampire. You know? I just think vampires have more fun on that show.
Oh, they get away with everything. I mean, jeez. But, well, awesome. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I really appreciate it. It's great finding another comic book geek out there. It's always fun.
Oh, well, there are a million of them.
Yeah. And I think I ran into most of them at Comic-Con with my arm. But I want to say thank you and keep working on the comic. I really hope you do a third series of them. They're
thank
great.
You. Thank you. Yeah, I hope so, too.
And there you have it. That was Michael McMillian, and he was awesome to talk to. As you can tell, we talked for quite a while about all things comic and geek. And just as a add to this, we have a lot of content still remaining that it just won't fit into one episode. So I have made the executive decision to split it into two. So we'll have a follow-up podcast sooner rather than later for you, which will have a little bit more of the Comic-Con coverage in it and a couple more interviews for you. And so I hope you enjoyed this one. Is part one of our Comic-Con coverage. And once again, thanks to Harhound for partnering with us on this one. Issue 30 is in stores now, so feel free to go to Barnes & Noble, pick it up. I think you'll love it. And we will see you again later on the Fangirl Podcast. Thanks. Bye.